halfway through the week here in the Main Street studio. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Welcome to this edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we're churning up something sweet with Marcia Murphy of Cows & Company Creamery in Carrington. From rich, authentic gelato made with Italian machines to award-winning Gouda inspired by her Dutch heritage, Marcia will be with us on another edition of Prairie Plates to let us know how her family is redefining dairy. Also, another edition of our new news podcast, Prairie Beat. And we open Main Street today by continuing our focus on Men's Health Month. That's June. We're with Dr. Eric Jacobson. He's a board-certified family medicine physician dedicated to providing comprehensive care for all patients of all ages. And he studied at the University of North Dakota. Dr. Jacobson, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
Why is it so important to focus specifically on men's health? And are there gaps or delays in how men generally approach their health care?
Well, there certainly can be, Craig. You know, men tend to put things off more than others, kind of watch, wait, hope things get better on their own, which things often do, but that's not always the case. We as men often are, especially in our Nordic culture here, can be a little bit more stoic, a little bit less apt to ask for help in certain situations or want to do things on our own more so. So taking the leap to just, be a little bit vulnerable, go and, speak with a physician or an advanced practitioner to talk about the issues that concern us and, symptoms that we might be having can be a little bit difficult. Little bit of a barrier for each individual person. So in that sense, yeah, I think access for men's health, granted there are, plenty of us out there who are happy and willing and, more than delighted to see men, just getting them in the door can be a little bit more of a challenge than their female counterparts.
Let's talk about those screenings. What do you recommend for men at various ages? Let's say starting from adolescence forward.
Yes, yeah. So a lot of what we deal with in primary care from a standpoint of prevention is looking at risk factors for cardiovascular disease and metabolic disease. So we will often start screening for cardiovascular risk factors even as young as like 9 or 10 years old. So we review people's family history, with the parents and kind of get an idea of prevalent issues that have plagued other family members or, trends that we've seen in health effects of other family members. And with that information, can recommend different screening tests for children, even as, like I said, as young as 8, 9, or 10 years old. So a lot of that has to do with, screening for risk factors for cardiovascular and metabolic diseases, as I mentioned. And then as we look at each individual patient in childhood or adolescence, their individual risk factors, their health habits, along with their lifestyle, we can offer other screening tests for other metabolic disorders and other issues that might be present there as well.
And as we age, are there certain benchmarks that, hey, when you are 50, you need to get a colonoscopy or
absolutely,
whatever that number is, because it seems to change.
Absolutely. So I mentioned cardiovascular metabolic screening, and that in itself is a really good reason throughout life to have an annual or semi-annual preventative exam. When we get to older ages, as statistics teach us, as those cancers can become more prominent at certain ages, we do enter like screening periods at other points in life. So colon cancer screening, our recommendation currently is to start that at age 45. Now that used to be age 50, many people are familiar with that. When you're 50, you get your colonoscopy. Well, unfortunately, we've been seeing in our country and worldwide really for the last several years that younger and younger people are being diagnosed with colon cancer at higher and higher rates. So for that reason, a number of years ago, the screening age was lowered from 50 to 45. And and colonoscopy can be a little bit of a daunting prospect for a lot of people. It's an intimidating test. It's an invasive test. It involves a couple of days of prep. You have to take a day off of work and go in for it and be sedated and all these things. So, kind of talking through that process, I think, helps a lot of patients, but also learning that there are other options other than just getting a colonoscopy for people who are at average risk for colon cancer. So there are stool tests like the Cologuard or the FIT test, much less invasive. They have their own bugaboos as far as like the sensitivity and specificity of those tests, the accuracy and utility of them. But for many people, that's going to be a very, very good option. And, I always tell patients, the best screening test is the one that you're actually going to do and get us the information that we're looking for to help reassure us that, you know, no disease is present. So having those conversations and developing a relationship with a primary care provider to develop that trust and be able to consult with them and kind of decide the best route of screening for yourself is a very good idea. So beyond colon cancer screening, specific to men, we do introduce prostate cancer screening as another option. The guidelines on prostate cancer screening are a little less clear. It's more of an individualized case-by-case decision. So that's where those conversations really become very, very important. And also an in-depth knowledge of a person's own family history. So for anyone who, say, has a first-degree relative, like a father or a brother who's had prostate cancer, the screening recommendation for them would be to start screening 10 years before the age of diagnosis of their family member. For men at average risk, typically we start to have that conversation around age 50. The USPSTF, United States Preventive Services Task Force, actually recommends considering screening at age 55, so a little bit above that, you know, 40 to 50-year-old mark. But those conversations can be ongoing throughout a person's life to determine their personal risk, their, you know, the degree of worry that they might have about that, because prostate cancer certainly is in the news, you know, frequently. We, you know, encounter people, high-profile people who have the diagnosis, and that ultimately adds awareness, which is a good thing. Outside of the colon and prostate cancer screening, for others who have other, you know, particular risk factors like a smoking history, there is an option for lung cancer screening for smokers who have smoked greater than 30 pack years. We calculate that based on the number of packs per day times the number of years smoked. So say you're a 50-year-old man who smoked a pack a day for 30 years. At that point, you'd be eligible for lung cancer screening with a low-dose CT scan to pick up any small changes, nodules in the lungs that could potentially become cancerous that we can watch, intervene on an early basis, and prevent progression of the disease. Or if there's certainly any active disease present, that would be caught on those screening tests as well.
What about physicals, annual checkups?
Yeah.
First of all, what age should someone take advantage of that opportunity? And B, what do you do in a physical today?
So every age would be eligible for an annual physical, and something that I would certainly encourage. We often see, you know, there's a standard in our country for well child visits up until the age of 18. So a lot of times kids, you know, just are in that routine, going every year, you know, at some point during the summer or school year, they get their shots that they might need, they get their sports physical done if they're in sports. We review all these little different health recommendations and talk about screening tests and good health habits. A lot of times after a young man turns 18, we see that kind of drop off if they're left to their own devices. Not at top of mind. Preventative health is not at top of mind for many teenagers and men in their early 20s. But I certainly encourage them to maintain that relationship with their primary care provider and moving forward, because there are a lot of health risks associated with that late adolescence, early adulthood period. So certainly in your upper teens, early 20s is a good indication, and then through up until age 30. Beyond age 30, you know, we do start to look at some of more of those, you know, cardiovascular risk factors, monitoring blood pressure and things like that, is that those issues can present, and depending on the person, can even present in your 20s, but, you know, more commonly will present in your 30s or 40s. So having those annual checkups to check your blood pressure, to review your health habits, monitor for any like risky behaviors, risk-taking behaviors, which for those younger age demographics in men is the leading cause of death. Accidental death is the most common cause of death and disability for men in their 20s. So kind of having a trusted person you can review those habits with and give you a little counsel and advice and maybe a little reality check every once in a while is a helpful thing. Now beyond that, you know, when you hit age 40, I'd say by that time you definitely want to, you know, be establishing a relationship with your primary care provider and getting in yearly for those screenings. So around that age is, in my practice anyways, when I typically start to do like annual cholesterol checks, screening for things like diabetes, screening for other metabolic disease, and then, you know, still, you know, maintaining discussions on maintaining good healthy habits and disease prevention just from a more holistic and, you know, lifestyle standpoint.
Got to talk about vaccinations, because there are a lot of them. And the news about vaccinations these days is maybe conflictive and maybe confusing. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the flu vaccine first.
So the flu vaccine comes out every fall. Typically, there's a meeting in the spring by ACIP, which is the committee that reviews all the data and information from viral transmission, different strains of viruses, and then recommends whatever version of the flu vaccine to be manufactured over the summer months so that it's ready for the fall. So some of those processes have been interrupted with the administration change and the change in leadership in our health departments. But to my knowledge, those processes are still ongoing and in place, and we do expect to have a flu vaccine this fall that's ready to be administered. So a lot of times we'll do flu blitzes, we'll call them, or just vaccine clinics where, you know, parents can bring their children in or any adults can come in and get their flu shot. You know, they're widely available at pharmacies, and often, you know, when in our regular visits during our clinic appointments, we'll be just inquiring patients if you're interested in the vaccination or anything like that. So flu vaccine, you know, it's
Is there any reason not to get a flu vaccine, in your opinion?
There are certain conditions. So certainly if you have any allergy to any components of the flu vaccination, or if you have, you know, particularly negative reactions to vaccinations in general, as far as, you know, side effects that you've experienced in the past that you'd just rather not experience again, getting another vaccine administration. Again, it's an individualized decision that is a conversation between a person and their provider. People who are at high risk for severe disease from influenza, so elderly populations, people with chronic comorbid conditions or immunosuppressed patients, we're going to more highly recommend it than, you know, a healthy person that's, you know, fit and active. But those people are eligible too. I consider myself a pretty healthy person. I've gotten a flu shot every single year for as long as I can remember, as long as I've been working in healthcare, certainly. So I certainly promote it with all my patients, unless there's a specific contraindication such as an allergy or other issues like that.
COVID vaccine, a lot of conflicting information recently.
Yes.
What's the best advice?
So I'm still a proponent of COVID vaccination. You know, I was entering my final year of residency when the COVID pandemic hit, working a lot in the hospital. And based on my personal experience, seeing what COVID can do to a person's health, I am of the mindset that we should do whatever we can to prevent those severe illness episodes. So what I recommend to my patients to get the COVID vaccine should they feel it's appropriate for them, and especially if they are at high risk for disease. So again, elderly population, 65 and older, we strongly recommend it. Anyone with chronic medical conditions or immunosuppressed status. Healthy adults otherwise, again, certainly eligible for it. The priority is slightly less just because, you know, most of us have had COVID at some point, and we know that there can be mild cases, there can be severe cases. When I'm counseling patients on it, a lot of what I'll be telling them about is, well, it's, you know, this vaccine, granted, it was developed in more of a, I wouldn't use the word rushed, but an accelerated state because of the risks of the pandemic and the widespread disease and death that we were seeing. It was prioritized to get this vaccine developed. The technology that was used to develop the vaccine, however, had been around for several years and had been very thoroughly tested. So the concerns that have come up with the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine, you know, I feel are a little overblown, likely. And
let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
Do you anticipate, A, that it will be available on time? And B, I remember when COVID first came about and we were talking about vaccines, there was the initial shot and then a booster.
Right.
A few months later, and then maybe it was annually. Is it still an annual recommendation as we speak?
Right. So there is a bit of confusion on that, understandably so, with some of the updated recommendations that did just come out of the CDC. Again, some of the regular processes and committees that were intact to make those recommendations have been a bit dismantled. So, you know, we're still kind of wading through a lot of that stuff. But yes, yeah, so initially it was you get your COVID shot, you get your booster shot, and then periodically as different strains of the virus evolve and become more prevalent in their rates of infection, new versions of the vaccine to cover those antigens to help prevent disease from those more virulent strains would be developed on an ongoing basis. Now, that's process has been slowed a little bit. One, for the vaccine uptake has been a little bit lower, and the effectiveness of those different strains or the virulence of those different strains certainly varies from moment to moment. So, and there's, you know, local considerations for that too, as far as what's prominent locally, what's not. The current recommendation is for any adult 18 or older, there is a recommendation to get, if you haven't had a 2024-25 COVID vaccine, that you should have that updated version. I believe, anyways, that there will be somewhat like an annual flu shot. That's kind of the schedule that we'll be on for COVID vaccine updates as well. So, and it certainly depends on, you know, the level of infectivity at locally and, you know, your personal risk factors and everything like that too. But yes, I believe there are COVID vaccines available now. There still are the same version that we've been administering in 2024-25. I don't know that there are plans for any change or updated version for the fall, but they will be available in the fall when we start to think about these viral respiratory illnesses becoming more prominent as we congregate indoors more frequently. And then again, same with the flu vaccine, those high-risk populations, so 65 and older, chronic diseases, immunosuppressed status, people who are affected by those conditions are going to be highly recommended to receive those vaccines to prevent severe illness and hospitalization, which uncontrovertibly the data shows that the vaccine is effective in doing.
Generally speaking then, if I hear what you're saying, you generally recommend that once a year you get a flu shot and a COVID shot.
Yes, that would be my recommendation.
And then here comes pneumonia vaccines. There's the shingles vaccine. Maybe there are other vaccines too. What are the age recommendations for those?
So shingles vaccine, or Shingrix as it's branded, is available starting at age 50 for the general population. It's a two-dose series. Shingles is a live vaccine. It can induce a bit more of an immune response than some others. So people often report feeling a little crummy for about a day afterwards. But shingles itself as a disease can cause a lot of really serious chronic issues, can threaten a person's vision. So that is one that
You see shingles here in North Dakota?
Oh, yeah, almost every week. Yeah,
and what you see, would the vaccine have helped?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Shingrix is a very effective vaccine. It's not, you know, no vaccine is 100%. I think it's over 90% effective in preventing shingles.
Is that lifetime then after that?
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Pneumonia.
So there's a number of different pneumonia vaccines for pneumococcal pneumonia. The general recommendation for people without respiratory conditions or other chronic illnesses that increase the risk for respiratory conditions is to get a pneumonia shot starting at age 65. Certainly there are other scenarios where even during childhood you can start getting pneumonia shot, or during adulthood, and those are a series of vaccinations, but general recommendation is 65 and up to get a pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine.
Annually?
Once. Just once. That's a one time. Yeah.
We're enjoying our conversation today on Main Street in light of June being Men's Health Month with Dr. Eric Jacobson. He's a board-certified family medicine physician at Essentia Health, and he's based here in the Fargo area.
I was told an analogy once a while ago about quality of life and retirement and just preparing for that and all the planning and work that we do from a financial standpoint to, you know, give ourselves the opportunity to enjoy our retirement. So we put money into our 401k, we sit on our nest egg, we do all this thought, put all this thought and energy into our financial future, which is very important. You know, obviously, if you want to retire at a certain age, you have to be able to have enough money to do so. One thing that we don't often think about is, well, if I have all this money and I want to live the certain lifestyle, what should I be putting into my body to be able to accommodate that lifestyle? So establishing regular exercise routines, both with cardiovascular and strength training at younger ages, has certainly benefits in the moment, but you're also investing in your body to be able to do the things that you want to do later in life.
I love that analogy. I'm guessing, Dr. Jacobson, that you have people that walk into your office today and say, hey, I know now, I just need a shot once a month to lose weight.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Bring it on. Let's go. That's all I have to do.
Certainly.
What do you tell those people?
Yep. The conversation starts with, okay, well, what are you doing now and what have you tried so far for weight loss?
No, come on. I want that shot, right? Because it works for everybody.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for everyone. And the people that it does work for, they have much better results if they're able to, in conjunction with use of the medication, and you're referring to like GLP-1 medications, in conjunction with the medication, you're able to adopt and maintain healthy lifestyle habits. That's when we typically see the lasting results with the aid of weight loss medications, if you're able to develop a comprehensive weight loss program, including potentially medication, but chief among those changes, your lifestyle as well.
I've seen on, I think, my Facebook feed, what I'll call these GLP-1 lookalikes, and I don't even know what they are, but they're marketed that way. And it's just like, okay, I don't even need to see my doc because I can just order this from Juno's pharmacy or whatever. I don't if it is a pharmacy, I'll just do it myself. In fact, it's even an injectable. It must be great.
Right. Yeah. So that's those are compounded medications. I listened to your conversation with Dr. Kohlhase, and I heard her mention one of the few benefits of the pandemic was adoption of telehealth. Well, this was another pandemic era change in legislation that allowed for compounding pharmacies and online entities to be able to prescribe medications that they're developing in these compounding pharmacies. And as with anything in life, it's not all bad, it's not all good. But what we see often in primary care and my colleagues in their weight management specialties is the accuracy in the dosing of these medications can be a little suspect at times. They're not FDA regulated, they're not FDA approved.
How can they be offered if they're not FDA regulated and approved? I don't understand that.
Well, I don't have a great understanding of it either. And those laws have actually, some of them have expired. The pandemic era laws have expired. There's some loopholes that some of these manufacturers and compounding pharmacies are still utilizing to be able to administer these medications. But I agree with you. I am not a big fan of that, the industry in general that's developed, because a lot of times it's let's get your credit card number for this monthly subscription. We're going to send you the meds. We're going to have a consultation initially through telehealth to, you know, make sure that this is relatively safe for you, but the follow-up is often lacking, and the comprehensive plan for weight management, which is where we're often going to see the most success, is certainly lacking. So, and this goes beyond weight loss medications. I mean, any sort of compounded medicine out there, you're going to find a lot of different options for those. So, you know, I certainly encourage my patients, if they have questions, bringing them to me. If they're on one of these medications, let us know about it so that we can be monitoring for any adverse effects, counsel them on the risks of those medications, and if appropriate, say, well, why don't we transition to something that's been studied, that's FDA approved for safety, because this thing that you're getting in a box in the mail, we can't guarantee what's actually in it, for one. And if you haven't had the proper education on its use, then, you know, all bets are off.
I want to talk about blood pressure. I'm guessing, Dr. Jacobson, you have men and women, but we're talking more about men today, who you tell for the first time you've got high blood pressure, and their eyes about pop out of their head because they had no idea.
Certainly, yeah.
Does that happen?
Oh, absolutely, almost every day.
So what should folks do relative to their blood pressure in their lives?
Yeah, so again, you know, there are a lot of lifestyle measures that a person can take to help to manage their blood pressure, but the first step is getting your blood pressure taken to discover whether or not it is elevated. So blood pressure has often been referred to as the silent killer because it often will not present with any symptoms. It can elevate slowly over time in our bodies, do remarkably adapt to change over time. So oftentimes we will not develop any symptoms of high blood pressure, and we can see people with severe elevated pressures and severe hypertension and have no idea that that's even a possibility for them. So that's where those annual check-ins become
highly treatable.
Very treatable, yes. Yeah, so that's where those annual check-ins become important to identify who is having those elevated pressures, and then discuss treatment modalities to get those down. So there are a whole host of medications, different classes of medications that can be used to help lower a person's blood pressure. You know, a lot of pushback that I'll sometimes get in managing a new diagnosis of hypertension is like, well, I don't want to be taking this medicine for the rest of my life. And my response to that is like, well, that's up to you. You know, that's, I mean, a lot of these things can be out of our control, but you do have a lot of control in adopting lifestyle habits that can naturally lower a person's blood pressure to reduce the need for medicine. Yes, I'm still going to recommend this medicine to stabilize things, to get you to a pressure to a healthy level while we work on these other aspects. So, but it's not a, me prescribing you a medicine is not necessarily a life sentence. And there are a lot of things that you can do to help it. You mentioned alcohol earlier. Chronic alcohol consumption is a major risk factor for hypertension. So reducing and with the potential to eliminate alcohol use can help. Looking at our sodium intake, if we're eating a lot of salty foods, that can elevate our blood pressure. Caffeine, as I sit here with a large cup of coffee in front of me, is a risk factor for high blood pressure. And as we talked about earlier, exercise. That's one of the biggest tools that we have to lower a person's blood pressure over time and reduce the need for medication to treat it.
Dr. Eric Jacobson has been my guest today. He's a board certified family care physician at Essentia Health, and he's talked to us about men's health. Dr. Jacobson, it's been a pleasure.
Same to you, Greg. Thank you very much.
Still to come in the second half of Main Street, we're scooping into something delicious with Marcia Murphy of Cows & Company Creamery. From handcrafted gelato to farm fresh Gouda with a Dutch twist, she's turning North Dakota dairy into a sweet and savory success story. That's still ahead on Main Street. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
Some barbecue,
applesauce, and some nice red beets.
There's the music that we hear on Wednesdays. It's Be Hungry. Rick Gian is with us. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me back, Craig. We're going to talk a little ice cream today, maybe some cheese, milk, cream, a special dairy up by Carrington, North Dakota.
Yeah, my first question is going to be, what is ice cream and what is gelato? And we're going to be chatting about that with Marcia Murphy. Her and her family are redefining what it means to make world-class dairy right here on the prairie. The gelato, of course, is from Cows & Company Creamery. Marcia, welcome to Main Street.
Yeah, hey, thank you so much. You guys had really nice things to say. I appreciate being here, and I'm excited to talk about the things I do all day, every day.
Okay, now Rick said ice cream. All of my notes say gelato. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so we make gelato. That's what we started off making. I'll start with the difference. I always forget that, but gelato is made with more milk than cream, so it's about half the butterfat compared to regular ice cream. So it's about 6 to 8% butterfat, while for it to be legally called ice cream, it should be above 14%, I believe. So we are dairy farmers here in Carrington, and I use all the milk from the dairy to make the gelato. So it's really nice for us since milk is the main ingredient and we have a lot of milk at our fingertips here. We have a gelato machine from Italy. So this churns the gelato in a specific way, slower and warmer compared to regular ice cream. So it takes out almost all of the air. So there's barely any air in gelato. So that's what makes it taste creamier. A lot of people think it has more cream in it, but it's just a more denser, richer product. And it's also served at a warmer temperature. So it sits a little bit nicer on the tongue compared to regular ice cream. It's a little bit more cold mouthfeel.
Yeah, it's a little more dense, and there isn't a custard used, right?
Correct.
My experience with gelato was really first in Italy, right? The birthplace of gelato, it sounds to me like. Is the gelato that I had there any different than what I'm going to have with your creations?
I think it depends where you get gelato in Italy. You have to look for certain shops. Some of them are kind of just tourist attractions and not technically authentic gelato. So it kind of depends. We make our gelato the traditional Italian way. And there are obviously a lot of traditional gelato makers in Italy, but they're sometimes hard to find.
Now, relative to flavors, is there certain flavors that you just really love?
So traditionally, the gelato should be smooth without any inclusion. So any like cookie crumbs or cookie dough or things like that. So like a smooth pistachio, a smooth hazelnut, a smooth vanilla, a smooth chocolate. That's the traditional way the Italians would make gelato. And we do that. We usually have a basic few flavors in our gelato case that are the rich, smooth flavors. But being in the Midwest, people do love their cookie crumbs and their additions to the gelato. So we do put a little twist on that, but we try to keep it as authentic as possible.
Yeah, and I've had some of the smoother varieties, the chocolate hazelnut. One recently was Kinder Bueno, and not many people know about those bars. They're chocolate wafer hazelnut cream bars, and you can get them at certain grocery stores, but more at specialty markets around here. But yeah, some of the other flavors are like blueberry cheesecake, cookies and cream, things like that. Every flavor I've had, though, Marcia, has been absolutely delicious. I mean, this gelato is really top tier. Are there any special other techniques you use for making this gelato?
You know, the biggest thing is just not cutting corners. We make all of our inclusions from scratch. So our brownies, our cookie crumbles, our fruit sauces, it's all fresh fruit. We never use frozen or pureed. It's all fresh fruit that we either make into a sauce or we just throw the fresh fruit in. So high quality ingredients is definitely an important factor for us. And then also just the freshness of the product. Our gelato is usually sold within a week. So it's really kind of actually a thing we can't control. We sell so much of it that it's really hard for our processing team to keep up. So in a way, it's great for the customers, always getting a fresh product. And it makes it a little bit easier for us in that way, always providing that.
Well, you can tell that it's very fresh. And you also make the cones you can put the gelato in and stroop waffles.
Yeah, the stroop waffles are kind of a fun addition. It's a traditional Dutch treat. It's two thin wafers with caramel on the inside and very popular in the Netherlands. A lot of people don't know about them here. They know about them as the Delta Flight snack. So it's definitely been an educational experience for us to teach people about stroop waffles. But once they try them, they really love them.
Now, Marcia, you've had success beyond gelato. And what's the relationship between this great tasty gelato you make us in summer and the fact that you won the Fargo Hot Dish Festival? Where does that tie come in?
That was kind of a super cool, fun experience. And yeah, we are super honored. So we have a small little cafe here at the Creamery. We're actually open a couple times a month. But we've recently started to do private reservation dinners. So we've really honed in kind of on the food scene a little bit as well, just making things from our products and using good quality North Dakota ingredients. So we've kind of been inspired by, you know, dabbling into the kitchen a little bit as well. So that's kind of where that came from. Our hot dish was definitely inspired by a traditional Dutch dish. So it was pretty easy for us. My mom would make something like that all the time when we lived in the Netherlands and Canada and still sometimes now. So that was kind of just a true authentic dish that she would make all the time that we were excited to bring to Fargo.
Were you or your family impacted by Friday's storms in any way?
Yeah, a little bit. We didn't, a lot of surrounding homes, farmsteads definitely got it way worse than we did. But lots of trees down, lots of branches, just a big mess. Our gelato trailer flipped over. We had some trees fall on fences that need to be fixed. And there was a little bit of damage to one of the barns at the dairy, but truly not nearly as bad as some people have had it. So we're pretty blessed.
Let's get back to that hot dish, because I was a judge at that event with our friend Molly Ye, and she's just amazing. The Gouda cheese crisps on top of that hot dish were amazing. And I'd like to get into some of the other products that you offer with the Goudas, because you have aged Gouda, young Gouda, and some flavored Gouda.
Yes. Yeah. That crisp was kind of the perfect touch for that hot dish. It's always fun to have something crispy in the meal that you're eating. It was just, we would just shred up some old Gouda, put it in the oven for a few minutes, and out came just a delicious crisp. So it's a super simple thing that people can make at home. But yeah, we make Gouda all the way from our youngest is aged for at least 60 days. So it's really mild and buttery in flavor. And as it ages, we actually have a cheese that's almost 4 years old now. It becomes more nutty, more caramel-like. It dries out a little bit. It's a little bit like the consistency of Parmesan. It's super good. I like both young and old cheese. And then we do, like you said, make some flavored Goudas. So our onion garlic's really popular. Our chives is really popular. We have an Herbes de Provence, which is kind of a fresh garden herb flavor. We make a lot of different types of cheeses, and that's what's fun about Gouda. It's very versatile.
And a cumin Gouda.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. There's not many Dutch people that don't have that in their fridge, but it's something people here have to get used to trying it.
Well, I'm getting used to it. I love your cheeses. Talk a little bit about the fresh milk and creams that are available. I picked those up at Brewhalla, but I'm sure at your shop in Carrington or near Carrington, some of that is available too.
Yes, so we make gelato, Gouda cheese, fresh cheddar cheese curds, and then we also bottle our whole milk in glass bottles, and we make chocolate milk and a mixed berry yogurt and a plain yogurt. So our milk is, it's A2 full fat milk, so we don't homogenize it, so the cream comes to the top. So when you buy our milk, you want to give it a good shake before you drink it, or you could take the cream off and put that in your coffee, whatever you would like to do with it. But yeah, it's a good wholesome milk, and we are excited to be offering that to the North Dakota community. If people want to come visit us at the creamery to visit our website, we have a schedule on when our cafe days are open. Brewhalla is open 7 days a week, so you can always visit there. We do have a little honor store here in Carrington that's also open 7 days a week. So if you're just looking to purchase our products and you're driving through Carrington, you're welcome to make a stop there.
Do you ship products?
Yes, we do ship our gelato and cheese nationwide.
How does that work when it's so hot outside?
I know. We ship our gelato overnight with dry ice. So when the weather is hot, we add a few more pounds of dry ice. In the wintertime, it's really nice because it's usually frozen here, so it makes it a little bit easier. But in the hot weather, it gets a little nerve-wracking if UPS isn't getting it there the next day.
Our guest has been Marcia Murphy from Cows & Company Creamery and Jessa Gelato. She's based in Carrington with her family. It's been a pleasure to have you with us on Prairie Plates.
Thank you so much.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Last weekend, many of us in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota experienced a weather event we won't soon forget. Here's more from our weekly news podcast, Prairie Beat.
It was July 4th, 1978. I was working at my first radio job out of college at KBOM in Bismarck, Mandan. Early that evening, I got a page from our station manager who said a tornado has hit Elgin and it looks like there may be fatalities.
I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for being here for another edition of Prairie Beat.
That's our weekly podcast featuring stories from the Prairie Public Newsroom. And of course, any longtime listener would recognize that voice we just heard as none other than Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson. And Danielle Webster, obviously this week we will be discussing the significant severe weather and tornadoes that took place over the weekend here in North Dakota, as well as Northwest Minnesota. I know anytime weather like this happens, it shakes a little dust off those memories of covering similar disasters over the years.
First thing I remember when we hit Elgin is that the only place in town that had lights was the hospital. I did some interviews with some people. They were willing to talk, although they were kind of shell-shocked from the experience.
5 people were killed in that Elgin tornado and 35 people were injured as well. It ended up being rated an F4, which is a very serious tornado. This weekend's storms reminded me of my own experience in covering tornado aftermath as well. On August 26, 2007, I hadn't even been working at Prairie Public for a year, and I got sent out to Northwood after a deadly tornado struck that community. 18 people were injured there, and one did tragically die. What Dave said about people being shell-shocked is something I remember, too. I will never forget the man who described to me grabbing his Hank Williams albums and a guitar before heading to the basement.
Priorities.
Yes. And then he came up, and there was nothing. But he was just grateful to be alive. You know, that tornado was very serious. It was rated an EF4.
Yeah, no, we're all probably thinking, looking at the damage in Enderlin, especially thinking, oh, EF4, but so far I think it's EF3+. So there have only been a handful of fatal tornadoes since 1978 in North Dakota, but as it would turn out, the storms that blew over North Dakota this past weekend were the deadliest since that night in Elgin. So far we've heard of 4 confirmed tragic deaths, 3 in rural Enderlin, and then a 4th near Courtenay.
The most devastating tornado in state history actually occurred 68 years ago to the day prior to Friday's storms. June 20th, 1957, the infamous Fargo tornado that some locals still have memories of. That tornado killed 10 people, injured more than 100 others, and demolished a pretty large portion of town. And that twister was not only historic because of that horrific damage, it was actually later studied by meteorologist and researcher Ted Fujita, along with several other notable tornadoes, to create what was later called the Fujita scale that rates tornado damage. So we've been saying F4, F5, etc. In 1971, that's when they began using the Fujita scale. The Fargo tornado was later rated F5, which is the most severe and devastating. In 2007, the Fujita scale was modified and enhanced, and they now refer to it as the enhanced Fujita scale. It measures not only the wind speeds, but the damage on the ground.
Yeah, so the F in Fujita could also stand for Fargo. That really started it all, and that historic F5 tornado. So that's a pretty big deal in meteorologic history. So since this past weekend's events, there have been a lot of discussions about the storms and media, obviously, probably around your water cooler, too. That tornado did hit rural Enderlin, and as bad as it was, and it was bad, it really could have been a lot worse.
No kidding. I mean, the damage that was done was widespread. The locations from Bismarck, Valley City, Jamestown, Page, Hunter, Enderlin, and other places into Minnesota as well. Everybody dealing with downed trees, power lines, damage to structures. A lot of people have been in cleanup and recovery mode in these last few days. The tornado that struck rural Enderlin and very tragically killed three people there. I mean, that night you and I were both watching the radar and from our basement hiding places as well in West Fargo. It was heading east. It was going toward Davenport, toward Horace. Thankfully, at the last minute, it was rear-ended by the other big storm of the evening that caused a lot of the damage everywhere else, something called a derecho. Local meteorologist Hutch Johnson, he does local weather forecasting here from YouTube and Facebook. He says he thinks that derecho could have saved the FM metro area and other communities around there from being hit by that monster tornado.
So these long-lived tornado-producing storms lasted from Stutsman County and are pushing into portions of western Cass County. And as they did so, this beast caught up with them. These storms were moving to the east at about 25 to 35 miles per hour. And the derecho out to the west was moving at over 60 and 70 miles per hour. And I do believe there's a chance that the derecho may have spared the Southern Valley, including the southern metro area of Fargo, because this storm cell was moving in towards Horace.
Yeah, I think he's right, because I was watching that live storm coverage that you mentioned, Danielle, and it did take a northeast turn there for a minute, and it had Horace in its sights, and I'm on the outer fringes of West Fargo just touching Horace, and so yeah, that's when we're like ready to hit the bathtub in our split level home. Just incredible to consider. Very spooky, the whole thing. Anybody and everybody that had to live through this is probably got a little bit of post-storm trauma, I would say. But man, when you think about it, I mean, we'll talk about a Freaky Friday. On the anniversary of the 1957 F5 Fargo tornado and that derecho, when you look at the radar, it actually really looked like a hurricane.
It actually did have some hurricane characteristics. In fact, it formed behind it something called a wake low, and that's basically a low pressure system behind the line of storms, and it causes that churning motion you could clearly see there. I think this storm will not only be remembered for years to come in the state, but it will probably also be studied for a very long time. Storm spotters, chasers, meteorologists, and even weather weirdos like you and I have all been talking about it for days.
Yeah, and star storm chaser Reed Timmer was all over it. And that was the first signal that something was going to happen. First of all, my father-in-law is looking at the clouds. He's from Enderlin, actually. And he's looking at the clouds moving one direction and the surface winds moving another. And he thought, like, okay, something's going
to happen.
Yeah, but Reed Timmer being in North Dakota signals something's going to happen. He's not going to waste his time with this giant armored vehicle that he's got. In fact, the Forum reported today that Reed stayed in Grand Forks for a night.
Yeah.
They had to kick him out of the hotel because everybody was coming up to take a look at his armored vehicle there. So now let's get a quick look at some other things brewing in the Prairie Public Newsroom. What are this week's three leads?
Number one, state library roof damaged in Friday's storm. The library is on the state capitol grounds in Bismarck and is over 100 years old. There's currently a temporary fix in place while they work to restore it. Number two, power back on after thousands go without electricity. Another storm headline, but a good development there. Katie David reporting about 5,000 people in Bismarck Mandan alone had lost power during the derecho, so getting that back up and running. And number three, April oil production down slightly, volatile pricing. I figured I could include one story not related to the storm. This is from the monthly Director's Cut report on North Dakota oil production. A lot of what's going on in the Middle East can have ripple effects here in North Dakota. We may be seeing those effects at gas pumps.
Yeah, especially if the Persian Gulf gets cut off by Iran or something, then prices definitely can go up. Well, I think we've all been through something, Danielle, this week, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for breaking all that down once again, Danielle. Be sure to look to the skies and pay attention to your local weather forecasters. Big shout out to them. They really did keep everybody safe with sort of a minute-by-minute, neighborhood-by-neighborhood, you know, analysis of how the storm was going to impact them. So
they really did.
Hats off.
And more severe weather coming this weekend, apparently. We'll have to keep our eyes open. Eyes to the skies.
And thank you for listening once again to another episode of Prairie Beat. I am Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Before we go, we want to take just a moment to acknowledge the communities affected by this past weekend's devastating storms. Our thoughts are with everyone who suffered property damage and especially with the families who experienced tragic loss of life. And remember, you can listen to episodes of Prairie Beat wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 25th. On this date in 1876, 6-year-old Red Fox was camped near the Little Bighorn when the 7th Cavalry arrived. Red Fox outlived Custer by nearly 100 years. He attended the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, gaining skills in writing and public speaking. In 1893, he joined Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and toured the U.S. and Europe for years. During a 1905 performance in London, he famously scalped King Edward VII. After the tours ended in 1910, Red Fox moved to Hollywood, appearing in 107 Western films, mostly silent. Red Fox also served in the U.S. Navy during the Spanish-American War and the Boxer Rebellion. He later worked as an interpreter for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In 1932, he moved to Corpus Christi, Texas. Over the next 40 years, he visited schools wearing full regalia to teach children about Plains Indian culture. His stories captivated students. Red Fox hoped to counter stereotypes of Native people seen in movies and on TV. In 1968, the superintendent of the Wahpeton Indian School saw Red Fox on Fargo television and invited him to speak. Students and staff were moved by his insight and respected his ability to speak of their families and traditions, even without knowing them personally. His goal was to guide Native children toward a strong and positive path in life. In 1971, McGraw-Hill published The Memoirs of Chief Red Fox, written on 14 school tablets. The book became a New York Times bestseller. Red Fox appeared on The Tonight Show, The Today Show, David Frost, and Dick Cavett. Though some questioned his authenticity, many, including University of North Dakota Indian Studies professor Greg Gagnon, saw Red Fox as a powerful and admirable figure. Gagnon wrote, "Red Fox was a fascinating Oglala Lakota, whose memoirs reveal the kind of man we all admire and should emulate." Red Fox died in Corpus Christi on March 1, 1976, just shy of his 106th birthday. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you've enjoyed your time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and another philosophical currents discussion. Jack joins us to explore the ethics of war and the challenge of treating everyone involved, soldiers, civilians, even enemies, with humanity. From moral responsibility to empathy in conflict, it's a powerful conversation about violence, justice, and the philosophical pursuit of peace. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope we'll see you again.